Any of you guys heard of the crypto sculpture that's at the CIA headquarters? Anybody know what I'm talking about? Oh, good. So Kryptos is a sculpture that is housed in the middle of the CIA headquarters in Virginia, done by a U.S. artist called Sandberg. It was put up in November of 1999. What it looks like a giant scroll that's being unraveled. It's about 20 feet long and 12 feet high, so it's pretty big. And it has four panels on it. The unique thing about this sculpture is that each panel has a coded message, and a long one too, about over 800 characters per message. Each of the panels, that uses a different code, and as you progress through the panels, the first one's the easiest, and the fourth one's supposed to be the hardest. This sculpture has become famous, not because it's in code or because it's a big copper sculpture, but because people have broken the code for the first three panels, but the fourth one they have not. Like I said, there's about 870 characters that they're trying to look at, and still 30 years later, nobody knows what that fourth panel says. You've had amateur code breakers go at it. People in the CIA for 30 past years have been trying to work on it. It's been so difficult that the artist has come in and he's given four clues to help people break it. And he's even told them that if you can solve the first three, there are clues in the first three to help you know how to solve the fourth. And still, to this day, when you look up unsolved codes in the world, Kryptos is one of the most famous ones that people still are trying to work on. Sometimes when we look at the Bible, especially the Old Testament, it feels a little bit like Kryptos. I don't know, maybe that's you today. Maybe you've tried to dive into the Old Testament, and you're like, man, there's so much of it I don't understand. And that's understandable, to be honest. There's a ton of people in the Old Testament that we don't know much about. The Amorites, the Philistines, the Syrians. We don't deal with these people today in our everyday life. There's rituals that we don't do. There's a story inside the book of Genesis where Abraham cuts a calf in half and walks between the two halves. You want to go, what in the world is he doing? There's all these kinds of rituals we don't understand. You know, and there's battles in the Old Testament that are bloody. There are sexual scandals in the Old Testament that the type of material that a children's Sunday school teacher would want to cover her kids' ears if we ever were just to read it. Not even to preach about it, just read it straight. They want to cover their kids' ears from hearing about it. And so the Old Testament can be tough to understand. Because of that, you know, there's been people who wanted to say, hey, this is what, they try to get the ideas of a meta-narrative, but this is what the general story about the Old Testament is about. And unfortunately, there's a very popular meta-narrative that goes something like this, that God in the Old Testament is all about following laws and wrath and judgment. But God, when you get to the New Testament, is all about grace and mercy and compassion. And a lot of people will say that. I mean, a lot of books I've read have said that kind of thing. But when we get to the Old Testament, we have to ask the question, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we had some clues to what this two-thirds of the Bible mean? You know, Sandberg, he gave four clues, plus telling other people what it's about. What if you gave us clues to help us understand, what are you trying to teach us in the Old Testament? The good news is, he did. In several places in the Old Testament, one of them being Nehemiah chapter 9. What is Nehemiah chapter 9? Think of it this way. Nehemiah chapter 9 is God's own sermon on what the Old Testament is about. It is God himself giving a commentary about his own book. And so, is the Old Testament really all about God's obedience and wrath and anger and judgment, while the New Testament is about grace and mercy? Or, and what is the overarching lesson that God wants even us today to get when we read these first two-thirds of the Bible? Well, let's see what Nehemiah 9 is about. Let me remind you what's happening up to this point so you know why they pray this prayer in Nehemiah 9. About 200 years before Nehemiah, if you haven't been with us, 200 years before Nehemiah, the Babylonians had come in and they destroyed Jerusalem. They destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and they exiled almost all the Jews out of Israel to other countries. They did that, the Bible says, because the Israelites were not following God. About 70 years after that, Cyrus the Great of Persia conquers Babylon and he Israelites, hey, y'all can go back to Israel, you can go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the city. And that's what some of them do. But it is not this glorious celebration, rebirth, like they thought it was going to be. In fact, it ended up being unbelievably hard. There was people who had moved in. I mean, it had been 70 plus years since they'd lived there. There's other people who had moved into their own houses, to their own farmlands, taking their own stuff. And they were still living there. On top of that, the Persians were still ruling them, and they had heavy tax laws. They had things like the draft for military things. And then a lot of the Israelites, even if they moved back to Israel, they never really gave up their idolatry. They didn't have much desire to follow God or desire to be obedient or to worship God only. It was a very dull spiritual atmosphere. And so they realize that they need to revamp their worship. They need to get back into what it means to truly worship God. And that's what they did starting in chapter 7 and chapter 8. In the seventh month of that year, it says, at the beginning of chapter 8, the Israelites come and they have this amazing revival worship service where they do 3 hours of preaching and reading the Bible and 3 hours of worship, and they're just celebrating God. And then they come back the second day and they find out in the Bible, it tells them in the seventh month that you're supposed to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. They haven't done that in 500 years, it tells us. And so they're like, look, we haven't done this in 500 years. Let's do this now. And so they go home, and it's been the next 2 weeks or so celebrating and preparing and celebrating for the Feast of Tabernacles. They get done with that. They go home, and you pick up in chapter 9, and they've only been home, if you follow the time scale, about a day or two. They've only been home a day or two. And they turn around and go back to Jerusalem for a third time. Because in their hearts, they still feel like they have unfinished business with God. They still feel like there's something that they've been clinging onto that they need to let go. And that's where you pick up the story, starting in verse 1. Let's read about the setting before we read the prayer, verses 1 through 4. It says, now, on the 24th day of this month, meaning the seventh month, the sons of Israel assembled with fasting and sackcloth and with dirt upon them. The sons of Israel separated themselves from all foreigners, and they stood and confessed their sins and the wrongdoing of their fathers. While they stood in their place, they read from the book of the law of the Lord their God for a fourth of the day, and for another fourth of the day they confessed and worshiped the Lord their God. Now, on the Levites' platform stood Jeshua, Bani, Kadmiel, Shebaniah, Buni, Sherebiah, Bani, Chenani, and they cried out with a loud voice to the Lord their God. So they come back and they realize that one thing they haven't done yet is confess their sins and really worship God. They worshiped God previously at the beginning of the month, but they haven't spent a time truly admitting that they and their fathers have done wrong. And you can see that they are, this is not just like, hey, we're coming because we're having a gathering. They are serious about this because it says they have sackcloth on, they have ashes on their head. I mean, they are showing signs of sorrow. And notice who's not in these four verses. Neither Ezra nor Nehemiah is mentioned. In other words, this isn't something where like the pastor is like, hey, we're going to do a service, like the baptism service. Hey, we're going to do a baptism service, a service at 5 o'clock. Everybody come back. That's not what happened. The people were like, we want to gather outside of the Sabbath morning worship because we feel like there's something we still have to do that we haven't gotten off our chest. This was a grassroots movement for them. And again, it turns into a huge service. 3 hours of preaching and reading the Bible. 3 hours of prayer and worship afterwards. 6 hours in total in this one worship service. All because they feel like they need to get this confession of their sin off their chest. And so in verse 5, begins this prayer that the Levites lead out as representatives of the people. And starting in verse 5, through the end of the chapter, what you have is essentially a summary of the Old Testament. They start with Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and they walk through the entire Old Testament. And this is God himself, through these Levites, explaining what is the message that God wants you to get from the first two-thirds of the Bible. Now, you know, if you've got your Bible with you, you know this is a lot of verses. So we're actually not going to read every single one of them. But what I do want to do is I want to kind of follow along, summarize these things, and I'll point out verses as we go and read them to you. And so the first thing we see is that God gave them this undeserved mercy just from the start. Initially, undeserved mercy upon these people. It says inside verse 6, it says, "You alone are the Lord, Lord. You have made the heavens, the heaven of heavens, with all their lights, the earth and everything that's in it, the sea and everything that's in them. You gave life to all of them, and the heavenly lights bow down before you." So they're starting in Genesis chapter 1, right? They say, okay, at the very beginning, God created everything. And what was creation's response when God created them? It was worship. I mean, God did nothing else for creation except created it. And creation's response, sheerly from the fact that God created it, was submission, love, and worship. This would imply, verse 6, that God deserves our submission, worship, and love sheerly because he made you. Even if God did nothing else, even if that was the end of the sentence, that no, he did no other mercy or grace in your life, sheerly from the fact that you were created by God, God deserves your submission, love, and worship. He says, actually, that's what creation does for him. So what do we do for him? Well, we find out coming next that God actually has done a lot more for us than just create us. Going through these Israelites' story, in verse 8, he says that God first keeps his promises with us. Down at the bottom of verse 8, he says, "You have fulfilled your promises because you are righteous." They go through Genesis and they talk about Abraham. They're like, look, you promised Abraham that he would have a people. You promised Abraham that his people would live in the land. And God, you keep your promises. That is a good thing that you have done for us. And they keep going. They get the book of Exodus in verse 9. They say, not only, God, did you keep your promises, but you saved us when we were in slavery. It says, "You saw the afflictions of our fathers in Egypt and heard their cry by the Red Sea. Then you performed signs and wonders against Pharaoh, against all of his servants, and all the people of the land. For you knew that they acted arrogantly toward them. You made a name for yourself as it is to this day. And therefore you divided the Red Sea before them, so they passed through the midst of the sea on dry ground. And you hurled their pursuers into the depths like a stone into the raging waters." He said, God, you have given us, and you have promised things to us, and you've given us the promises. God, you have saved us from our slavery. Third, he talks about how God directed them and guided them when they were lost. Verse 12, "And with the pillar of cloud you led them by day, the pillar of fire by night, to light for them the way in which they were to go." Number 4, God gave them good laws to help them live blessed lives. He didn't just pull them out of Egypt and say, hey, y'all just do whatever you want, even if it's harmful. No, God said, hey, look, these things are harmful, and these things are helpful, and if you do these helpful things, you'll live blessed lives. So it says in verse 13, "Then you came down on Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heaven. You gave them just ordinances and true laws, good statutes and commands." And then fourth, when they were hungry, God gave them food to eat. When they were thirsty, God gave them water to drink. Verse 15, "You provided bread from heaven for them for their hunger. You brought them out of, you brought out water from the rock for them for their thirst. He told them to enter it in order to take possession of the land which you have sworn to give unto them." So let's recap up until this point. God created creation, and that was all it took for creation to want to love, worship, and submit to God, right? That's what we saw in verse 6. But then God did way more for these guys, and honestly, for us, right? He didn't just create us. He said God kept his promises with them, that God saved them from their slavery, that he gave them laws to help them live great lives, that he guided them when they were lost. He guided them when they've had a wilderness experience, that when they were hungry, he gave them food. When they were thirsty, he gave them drink. I don't know about you guys, but I identify with some of those things God has done in my life, too. So if creation worshiped God just by being created, what do you expect their response to be from God, or to God? But how did they respond? It says, verse 16, "But they, our fathers, acted arrogantly, and they became stubborn. and they would not listen to your commands. They refused to listen and didn't remember your wondrous deeds which you performed among them. So they became stubborn, and they appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt. What? I don't know what you got, but can you believe that? Think of all those good things I just listed out. Think of all the stuff that God had mercifully poured onto them. The Israelites have done nothing for God yet. This was surely God's initial pouring out, his initial pouring out of mercy, which is the next point up there. Initial pouring out of mercy upon them. And their response is to turn from God. And they didn't just turn from God. They said, we want to go back to Egypt. They said, this is cool, but we want to be slaves again. Like, how can we do that? Well, we got to be careful when we read these stories. Because, I don't know about you guys, but how often do these verses characterize a decision you've made in your life? Or a time when you've done something in your life that's just like that? I'll tell you something about sin. They want to return to slavery because sin makes people do stupid things. That's what sin does. And so imagine that you're God. What would you do to these guys if you were God at this point? What did God do? We keep reading at the end of verse 17. But you are a God of forgiveness, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in mercy. And you did not abandon them. Even when they made for themselves a calf of cast metal and said, this is your God who brought you out of Egypt and committed great blasphemies, you still, in your great compassion, did not abandon them in the wilderness. God didn't abandon them. He forgave them. So you see not only God's initial undeserved mercy, but you see his continued undeserved mercy on them. I mean, he didn't just forgive them. If you keep reading in these next passages, you'll see verses 19 through 20 mirror earlier. In other words, he kept giving them the things he had earlier. Despite the fact that they didn't respond like they're supposed to, he still gave them food when they were hungry. He still gave them water when they were thirsty. He still sent the pillar of cloud to guide them when they were lost. He still sent his law and his spirit to guide them so they had a blessed life. All of the merciful things he gave earlier, he continued to give to them. Why? There is no reason except it was a continued undeserved mercy upon them. And we get to, therefore, the end of the book of Deuteronomy in this passage. And starting in verse 22, you hit the book of Joshua. And we learn one other good thing that God pours upon them that they don't deserve. And that is that God gave them victory over their enemies. In verse 22, it says, you also gave them kingdoms and peoples and allotted to them as boundaries. And they took possession of the land. He says, God gave them victory over their enemies over that time. And you'll go on and see inside verse 25 that it wasn't just about victory. He gave them good things in the land. Verse 25 says they captured fortified cities and fertile land. They took possession of houses full of every good thing, carved out cisterns, vineyards, and olive groves, fruit trees in abundance. In other words, when these Israelites got into the land, it was already done. They didn't have to build any houses. There was houses already built. They just had to move in. They didn't have to go to Sam's and stock their fridges. All the fridges and all the houses already had food in them. They didn't have to drive their wife's car to go get gas. All the gas tanks were already full. That's a miracle in itself. So they didn't have to dig wells. The wells were already dug. They didn't have to plant their fields. All the fields were already planted and already had fruit. They didn't have to do nothing. God gave them everything they possibly could want. He took them out of slavery to give them of abundance. And in the end, it says, in verse 25, they live luxuriously in your great goodness. This is God's continued undeserved mercy to them. Now you pause there and you go, okay, we saw what they did last time. Surely, surely, this time it's going to be different, right? I mean, God had way more good things on these guys than they ever deserved, certainly more than he did for creation. This has got to be a different response. Verse 26, for they became rebellious and revolted against you, and threw your law behind their backs and killed your prophets who admonished them in order to bring them back to you, and they committed great blasphemies. Wow. And so again, if you were God, what do you think you would do at this point? How do you think you would feel if you were God and you poured such goodness on somebody like that? And this is how they responded back with that goodness. How do you think you would feel if you were God? Well, what does God do next? We see in the next part, you have God's patient, undeserved mercy. In verse 27, you hit the Judges, the book of Judges. It says, therefore you handed them over to their enemies who oppressed them. When they cried out to you in the time of their distress, you heard from heaven, and according to your great compassion, you give them people who save them from their enemies. So in the book of Judges, God lets them get captured by their enemies this time. And as soon as the people are in distress, as soon as they have financial problems, as soon as they have health problems, as soon as their family's in disarray, they run back to God and they say, I'm sorry, God, I'm sorry, please help us. And you know what it says God does? He helps them. He helps them. He says he gave them saviors to save them from their oppression. And so how do they respond to that? Verse 28, but as soon as they had rest, they did evil again before. As soon as the health problems were over, as soon as the financial problems were over, as soon as the family problems were over, they went back to doing what they had before. In other words, they were abusing God's mercy. They weren't embracing God's mercy. They were abusing God's mercy. And so how does God respond? He lets them get taken by enemies again. They get their enemies. They get into their straw again. They cry out to God again. And how does God respond this time? He saves them again. He helps them again. In fact, it says, when they cried out to you again, verse 28, when they cried out to you again in heaven, you heard from heaven many times, and you rescued them according to your compassion. Verse 30, however, you remained patient with them for many years, and you admonished them. Every time they abused God's mercy, God gave them mercy again just when they asked. And so it says inside verse 30, this is when God starts to send the prophets, and this is the ministry of the prophets in the verse 30, and admonish them by the Spirit, your prophets, yet they wouldn't listen to them. What's the point of the book of prophets, the prophetic books? The point of the book of the prophets was God's loving message to these guys. He's saying, look, come back to me. Like, what more do I have to do? What other good things do I need to pour in your life that would make you want to respond? How much more mercy do you need to see in order to want to follow me? That was the prophetic message. And said, yeah, there's warnings of judgment, but every warning of judgment, the prophet was not intended to be delivered, but intended to make them want to repent. Just like when you tell your kids, hey, don't do that, or you might get disciplined, you don't want to discipline your kids, right? You warn them because you want them to not do it. That's the prophets. It was God's love pouring out on them saying, stop. Stop doing the sinful, dumb things you're doing. And come back to me so you can live. That's the book of Judges all the way through 2 Chronicles. You get to the end of 2 Chronicles or just end of 2 Kings. And you get to the exile that I spoke about at the beginning. Verse 30, the end of it says, therefore you handed them over to the peoples of the lands. Nevertheless, in your great compassion, you did not make an end of them or abandon them, for you're gracious and a compassionate God. It says, even in the very end, when they went to exile, God didn't destroy all of them. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when I read this passage, I think, God should have destroyed all of them. Is that how you feel when you read what these guys are doing? Like, they don't deserve God to not destroy them. And yet, even in the exile, it says, in your great compassion, verse 31, your great compassion, you did not make an end of them, nor did you abandon them. Holy cow. And so you get to verse 32, and verse 32 is the present day for them. It's God's undeserved mercy, and they're going to say how this time that generation is going to respond to it. And we know the date of this. It's October 31st, 445 BC. We know the exact date when this happened. And this generation of Israelites in our story is a little bit different. They've looked at the Old Testament, and this is the lesson they've drawn. Verse 32. Then now our God, the great and mighty, the awesome God, the one who keeps his covenant and faithfulness. Do not let all the hardships seem insignificant before you, which has happened to us. Verse 33. However, you are righteous in everything that has happened to us, for you have dealt faithfully, but we have acted wickedly. Verse 36. Behold, we are slaves today, and as for the land which you have given to our fathers to eat, its fruit and its bounty, behold, we are slaves in it. Verse 37. And so we are in great distress. This generation looks at this story, and they go, God, you are the one who's always faithful, and we are not that faithful. God is the one who always keeps his word. We are the ones who don't really keep our word. God is the one whose character is always impeccable, even when our character toward him is insulting. And they look at their state, where they're at, and they admit that they're in trouble. And the words used in this section are the same words used earlier to talk about the Exodus, where it says the Israelites cried out to God and he saved them. And then it talks about the Judges period earlier. It says they cried out to God and God helped them. It's the same words in these last few verses. And they're essentially going, God, we're in trouble again. And we need you to save us. But we understand this. We don't deserve to be saved. You're the one that's faithful. We have not been faithful. You're the one that's kept your word. We have not kept your word. You have an impeccable character. We have an ignorant, insulting character. We do not deserve for you to save us again. But we ask you to save us again, sheerly because that's just who you are. That's just who you are. You are a God who is compassionate and merciful and forgiving and patient, full of loving kindness. And they just fall sheerly on that undeserved mercy from God to help them in their current plight again. And so we get to this end and we're like, okay, by the way, verse 38, they're going to say, they're going to make an agreement in writing. That's what they have next. In other words, they say they're going to do better again. So you get to the end of verse 39 and you go, okay, why was this generation of Israelites different? You're talking about a time period from verse 6. Even if you don't even begin verse 6, if you just begin with Abraham in verse 7, all the way through then, you're talking about a time period for them that was 1,500 years of generations. That's a long time. Why was this generation different from every generation for 1,500 years prior to it? Because they recognized that God's mercy was undeserved. That was the difference. They recognized that God's mercy toward them was undeserved. And when they recognized that, and I don't mean like in their head, I mean when they really felt it, it changed. But they had this hope that even though they knew that God's mercy was undeserved, they could fall on his grace again because of who he was. And the lesson is still true for us. The main point I have for you to take away is recognize that God's mercy is undeserved toward you. That for you too, God's mercy is undeserved. You know, a lot of times when we look at our lives, our sinfulness, you know, maybe you see yourself in chapter 9, maybe you don't, but a lot of times in our culture, we don't like to take blame for stuff. We don't like to admit that we've sinned, we've had fault. You know, we want to blame how we're acting in our parents and the way they raised us and the circumstances we have or the friends group. Or our emotions. We're like, well, my emotions just took over and I did stuff. We don't like to accept personally that we have wronged God, we have sinned. But the reality is, unless you personally admit that you have wronged God, then you cannot personally receive God's mercy either. And regardless of how we want to admit it, we all should see ourselves in Nehemiah chapter 9. We all, myself included, should see our lives in Nehemiah chapter 9. You know, the girls in the summer, they love to make a mess. And the accumulation happens fast in the Mills house, in the living room. And it drives us nuts. And I'll just give you a typical time, like a single day. I'm not talking about a week. This is a single day at the Mills house. They get home from doing something fun, and they immediately take off their dirty clothes, and they just throw them on the ground in the middle of the living room. And then they're like, okay, let's go play with Play-Doh. So they open up all the Play-Doh, and they get it out, and they make crumbles all over the floor, and they're in the middle of playing it. They decide suddenly they don't want to play with Play-Doh anymore. They want to do dress-up. So they leave the Play-Doh where it is, tops open, pieces everywhere. They go to their dress-up. They get all dressed up, their jewelry and their suit, their dresses and their shoes, and they walk around for a bit and they get bored of that. Like, you know what, we want to play with blocks. And so they take off all the dresses and they just leave them right there in the living room wherever they fall. They go to the blocks, they take the blocks thing, they just dump it across the kitchen floor. And that's just probably like a 1 hour period at our house every day. Drives us nuts. Let me tell you what, it does not take much to take a clean living room and turn it into a messy room. And so we tried to do something different this year. This summer we're like, hey, at 4 o'clock every afternoon, we're gonna make the girls pick up their stuff and put it in a giant basket that we have, really two baskets that we have in our room. And we're gonna make them clean up the living room every day instead of just leaving it there where you're tripping over stuff all afternoon. And the girls don't like it. They don't like it one bit. I would like to admit, Millie cries every day at 4 o'clock. They don't like it.
It won't hurt them.
It don't hurt them, you're right. So they put them in this basket. The problem with the plan we have is they can't pick up these baskets once they're full of all their stuff. It's too heavy, it's too big. And so the baskets really just get left in the living room. So the living room is tidied, but the stuff is still there. It's just in a giant heap in a basket. And that's how our sin is. That was one day at the Mills house. Imagine your sin like that, week after week, year after year, accumulating on your soul. Imagine the weight that must feel. Imagine the heaps of it. And you could try to make your life better. You could try to put it in a neat little pile. But the reality is it might be sin in a neat pile, but it is still a weight in your soul that you can't budge. Right. Oh no. The good news about the Mills house is even though Millie and Josie can't move those giant baskets of all their stuff, there is somebody in the house who can, and it's their father. I can pick up that basket, and I can take it away where it's no longer in the living room, and they don't see it again. And that's exactly what God our Father did for you. When Jesus went on the cross, it wasn't just the weight of that wooden cross that he carried as he walked through Jerusalem. God put the weight that we've talked about of your sin on Jesus. So that all you have to do, if you just take your basket of sin that you've accumulated over your life, and you say, Jesus, I can't get rid of it, and I can't pick it up, and I don't even deserve you, because look how big this basket is. I don't deserve you to take this away from me, because I'm the one that put it here. God, you didn't put it here, I put it here. Just like the kids are the ones that put the toys in the living room. God, I'm the one that put this mess here. I don't deserve for you to take it away because you're not the one that put it there. But if you would just take it away from me, God, guess what he does? He will. Jesus will take it, he'll put it on his back, and he'll take it up to that cross forever. I speak to people sometimes, and I'll lead them through prayers of, you know, forgiveness and commitment to Jesus. And especially adults, not so much for kids and teenagers, but especially for adults, so often, they'll tell me, man, when I prayed that prayer, it felt like a weight came off my shoulders. And they're like, I just feel lighter. I actually had a youth one time say, man, I feel like I do 100 push-ups after that. And that's what it, you know, it doesn't happen every time, but that's what it is. And you might be here today and you're like, look, you don't know how bad I've been, Michael. I've been putting on a face. My parents think I'm awesome. My kid, my spouse thinks I'm great. Everybody thinks I'm so perfect. Michael, you don't understand. I'm really not that perfect. I have messed up a lot. Let me tell you this. There is no way you are worse than the Israelites in Nehemiah chapter 9. There is no way you have done God worse than what these guys did to God. Yet God saved them every time. If anybody comes to God in Jesus and says, God, will you just forgive me because of your mercy? Everybody finds this one truth about God to be true. But you are a God of forgiveness, gracious and compassionate, slow. slow to anger, and abounding in mercy, and you did not abandon them. Everybody finds that to be true if you embrace Jesus. So we ask ourselves, what is the Old Testament all about? You know, is the Old Testament all about God being mean and having wrath and judgment and sending laws? Well, the New Testament is the one about grace and mercy. No, my friend, that's completely wrong. There's one story throughout the entire Bible. It was written over 1,500 years by hundreds of different authors. It has one consistent story, and that is that God will give you undeserved mercy if you seek it from Him. It's the story of the Old Testament. It's the story of the New Testament, too. It all comes from Jesus Christ. So the main point, again, is recognize God's undeserved mercy to you and then respond appropriately to that mercy. The next few moments, I'm going to pray and give you a chance to respond in our time of invitation to that. And maybe you're here today and you were like those Israelites. You felt like, hey, I have unfinished business with God. I've been going through things. I've been holding something back. But I feel like I have unfinished business with God. What a great time during the time of invitation after I pray to make it not unfinished business, to complete that business you know you have with Him. Well, maybe you're here today, and I'll encourage you to recognize God's undeserved mercy and recommit yourself to Christ. You know, let me tell you something. I'll give you a little secret. It is not a weak Christian thing to recommit yourself to Jesus. Mm-hmm. We should be recommitting ourselves to Jesus every morning when we wake up. And one way to respond adequately and appropriately to God's undeserved mercy is to say right here in June 8th, at the beginning of the summer, I am going to recommit myself to be the Christian that God's called me to be, because I've seen God's undeserved mercy in my life over and over and over again. That's a wonderful thing, no matter where you stand in your faith, to do. Or maybe you're here today and you say, you know what, I feel that weight of sin on my life. And you want to pray this prayer I told you about earlier that I've done with people asking God's forgiveness. Whether you've done that before once or you've not done that at all, as the music plays, come talk to me and I'd love to walk you through that prayer so you can have Christ lift that burden of sin off of you and you can find forgiveness today.